Good morning to panel three in this Rawls Symposium. We will start already because the sooner we start, the longer we can discuss on the subjects that our panelists are going to present. Thank you all for attending this panel. I will give the floor, first of all, to Christoph Chediora from the University of Lodz, who's going to present the paper, the deontological meaning of justice as fairness. So, Mr. Chediora, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I will start immediately. So, Rawls drew his distinction between deontological and teleological theories in the context of British and American philosophy on the 19th and 20th centuries. It was Jeremy Bentham who first coined the term deontology in 1814. It's kind of ironic that Bentham used this term to describe his own philosophical position. I quote here, "By deontology, taken in its largest sense, is meant that branch of art and science, which has for its object the doing on each occasion what is right and proper to be done." The end of quotation. The phrase "what is right and proper" refers to the Greek term deon, which means obligation, necessity, or duty. If our duty is to maximize the net amount of happiness, then deontology teaches us what we should do to maximize general happiness. It seems odd today, of course, to say that deontology is the same as utilitarians. It was the dispute between intuitionists and utilitarians of the 19th century which was relevant to a contemporary understanding of the distinction between deontology and teleology. The question was how we can know what our duty is. The intuitionists argued that we can know what our duty is by intuition, a kind of direct perception of the truth of certain ethical statements. We don't need to consider the consequences of our actions to determine the content of duties. On the contrary, the utilitarians claim that we must use reasoning in which the consequences of our actions are taken into account. However, the epistemological question, how we can know what our duties are, should be distinguished from the question what our duties are. Henry Sidgwick was the first who noticed the difference between these two questions, although he got us into a confusing mess at the same time. He distinguished three methods of ethics: intuitionist, egoistic hedonist, and universalistic hedonist, that is, utilitarianist. Each of these is justified by intuition on or relies on intuition. So they are intuitional theories in epistemological terms. However, only intuitionists reject considering the consequences to determine duties. It is then the ontological theory in a contemporary sense of this term. Sidgwick distinguished two senses of intuitional, narrow and wider. Sidney Broad tried to clean up the mess Sidgwick left. Broad proposed to divide ethical theories according to two different criteria. One of them is epistemological, the second one is ontological. If we apply the first one, we get the distinction between intuitionist and empirical ethical theories. If we apply the second one, we get the ontological division of ethical theories into deontological and teleological ones. According to deontological theories, I quote, there are ethical propositions of the form such and such kind of action would always be right or wrong. In such and such circumstances, no matter what its consequences might be, the end of quotation. According to teleological theories, the rightness or wrongness of action is always determined by its tendency to produce certain consequences which are intrinsically good or bad. broad understanding of the distinction between deontological and teleological theories became standard in the 20th century. However, I would like to mention one more philosopher, namely William Frankenna. It was his textbook, Ethics, which Rawls referred to in A Theory of Justice. According to Frankenna, I quote, a teleological theory says that the basic or ultimate criterion or standard of what is morally right, wrong, obligatory is the non-moral value that is brought into being. The final appeal must be to the comparative balance of good over evil produced. Thus, an act is right if and only if it produces, will probably produce, or is intended to produce at least as great a balance of good over evil as any available alternative. An act is wrong if and only if it doesn't do so. The end of quotation. By contrast, and I here quote Frankenna once more, deontological theories deny what theological theories affirm. Rawls reformulates the definition of teleological theories and embraces the negative definition of deontological ones. Teleological theories define the good independently from the right and define the right as the maximizing the good. Deontological theories deny this. Deontological theories then, firstly, may not define the good independently from the right, or secondly, may reject the definition of the right as maximizing the good, or thirdly, may accept both negative statements. Rawls says that justice as fairness is a deontological theory in the second way. Namely, it doesn't define the right as maximizing the good. I leave aside the question of whether justice as fairness is a deontological theory in the first sense, namely, the question of whether the good is defined, at least in part, in terms of the right. I think it is, but I'm not going to argue for this now. If the main characteristic of justice as fairness, as the deontological theory, is that it doesn't define the right as maximizing the good, we can ask how the right is understood. I would like to give an interpretation of the deontological meaning of justice as fairness, which explains why it is expressed in deontological language of rights, liberties, obligation, and so on. According to this interpretation, the deontological or teleological character of morality lies in the choice of subject of morality. For deontological theories, it isn't simply the notion of the right, but a set of interpersonal relations. Morality regulates relation between persons. It determines a proper or right attitude to others. For teleological theories, the subject of morality is an object of our desires or appetites that may be perceived as good. The distinction between the right and the good reflects the more fundamental distinction between two kinds of relations, a relation towards another person or relation towards an object of an appetite. I borrowed this insight from Rawls' early work, A Brief Inquiry into the Meaning of Sin and Faith, which was published and edited by Thomas Nagel after Rawls' death. It's Rawls' senior thesis submitted to the Department of Philosophy of Princeton University in December 1942. This work of young Rawls, who was only 21 of age at the time of writing, is a piece of theological ethics. Theological, not to confuse with theological. For the young Rawls, I quote, ethics should be an inquiry into the nature of community and personality. Man's chief moral problem is how to live with himself and with other men, the end of quotation. His theological ethics is based on four fundamental presuppositions about the existence of God, personality, community, and two different realms of the personal and the communal. I would like to make some brief comments on striking similarities between the theological ethics of the young Rawls and his late political liberalism. If we put aside Rawls' Christian belief in God, of course, young Rawls, we can see that the two fundamental notions are these of community and person, whereas the two main ideas of political liberalism are those of society and person. It's obvious that ideas of political liberalism are more elaborated and they need to be set in a different context, namely in the context of political, not theological conception. For this reason, among others, Rawls avoids talking about community and he prefers to use the word society to the word community. However, I am sure that there is an underlying continuity here. The main idea behind the understanding of community in the young Rawls is that community is something more than a group of individuals who act together because it's beneficial for them. This something more is faith, which is a kind of integration into community, a proper attitude towards others. For both the young and the late Rawls, community or society revolves around some normative core. It is bound by normatively regulated attitudes of their members towards one another. In a brief inquiry, person is defined by her ability to form a community and enter into it. This ability is rooted in our nature because we are created in God's image. God is a perfect union of three persons. Our nature reflects this perfect community. In political liberalism, of course, there is no theological explanation of our nature. Person is explained in political terms, and it is defined by having two moral powers, namely the capacity for a sense of justice and the capacity for a conception of the good. The capacity for a sense of justice accounts for the concept of society. We don't want simply to cooperate with others. We want to cooperate with them on fair terms. We are, I quote, ready to propose principles and standards as fair terms of cooperation and to abide them by them willingly, the end of quotation. Rawls calls our capacity for a sense of justice reasonability, and he distinguishes it from rationality. Rationality, on the other hand, is our capacity for a conception of the good. The distinction between reasonability and rationality can be roughly mapped onto the distinction between personal and natural relations. Personal relations are relations between persons. Natural relations are between person and object of her desire or appetite. Personal relations are communicative and both sides of them are actively involved. They form a nexus, as Rawls calls it. Namely, they are connected in such a way that my actions affecting one person affect all other persons at the same time. Personal relations are unique. This is a consequence of the fact that persons involved are unique as well. Personal and natural relations consumes different kinds, as Rawls calls it, energy. Rawls states that, I quote, in natural relations, the energy is desire, appetition, bodily want, desire for beauty, and so on. In personal relations, the energy is hate, jealousy, pride, envy, and sometimes givingness, fellowship, and so on. Hence, it appears that natural relations are egoistic, while personal relations are motivated by egotism or by fellowship and love. Desires and appetitions are by nature egoistic and therefore self-centered. The end of this long quotation. Egoism is involved in our desiring some object we perceive as good. However, striving for an object is not always wrong. Rawls distinguishes four kinds of appetitions. The first are concrete physical or bodily desires, like, for example, hunger. The next two kinds of appetitions are rational and aesthetic, for truth and beauty. These all three kinds of appetitions are legitimate. That is, when we desire some physical object or enjoy a beautiful thing, we don't do anything wrong, although we don't do anything good in a moral sense either. In his late works, mainly in political liberalism, rationality, which is our ability to form a conception of the good and realize it, is defined in a similar way to egoism. Rationality is not a source of principles of justice, although it must be taken into account. Seeking a good is justified as long as it is in accordance with principles of justice, that is, with reasonability. Egoism becomes wrong or a sin when we desire or treat another person as an object. This is a wrongful desire. However, egoism or sin of egoism is based on more basic fundamental sin of egotism. The general definition of sin is that it is a way of destroying or abusing community and personal relations. Egotism is then an attitude of person towards others, which involves treating them as inferior or showing one's own superiority. It can take many forms, from pride, vainglory, to pretending modesty or self-satisfaction with one's own morality. Rawls strongly rejects personal relations which are not based on equality. This kind of relations means abusing community and other persons. In Ethics, the young Rawls firmly rejects teleological conception of ethics. I quote, "We do not believe that so-called good life consists in seeking any object, but that it is rather something totally different, a matter of personal relations," the end of quotation. Rawls even calls the phrase good life a detestable phrase. It is detestable because ethics is about right or proper attitude towards others, or about community, that is about a just society, not about the good, that is about turning personal relation into natural or persons into objects. If we were looking for a sense of the right which would define the deontological meaning of justice as fairness, I am sure it is the right which will involve relations between persons or citizens. These relations are better described in a deontological language of rights, liberties, or duties than they would be described through the impersonal good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very interesting, and thank you for sticking to the time. And now it's time for Andrei Bespalov. Please give you the floor.
Thank you very much.
I make useful of this break. Simply telling the participants in this panel, those people who are attending this panel online, that after Bespalov's speech, you will have the chance to put your questions through the question and answer option. And then I would read your questions in order for the panelists to answer to you. So if you have any questions, you will have the chance to put it at the end of Bespalov's presentation. So please.
Well, thanks for this remark, John. It's also a useful remark for me. How we're supposed to ask our questions. So I'm Andrei Bispalov. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Warwick. And today I'm going to talk to you about some tensions between John Rawls's ideas of public reason and civic friendship. The weird tone and intonation in my voice is due to the fact that the host disabled participant screen sharing. I was trying to share some small presentation with you, but it seems I cannot. Anyway, I'll try to do without it. So, what may be the problem between the ideas of civic friendship and public reason in John Rawls? According to Rawls and political liberals, it is sufficient for civic friendship that citizens fulfill the requirements of public reason. Namely, they should publicly support only those legal provisions that are justifiable on the grounds of reasonable political conceptions of justice, or liberal political conceptions of justice, let's put it this way, such as Rawls's own justice as fairness. I will argue that when we clarify Rawls's own notion of civic friendship, we'll find out that it requires more solidarity that is necessary to realize liberal justice. And therefore, the commitment to public reason and the commitment to liberal conceptions of justice is insufficient for maintaining civic friendship. And furthermore, legal provisions aimed at maintaining civic friendship cannot be publicly justified. So what we are going to do, what I suggest that we do, I suggest that we take a look at how Rawls understand civic friendship. Then we'll take a brief look at how they argue that the commitment to public reason brings about civic friendship. And then my aim is to show you that this connection, this wonderful connection between public reason and civic friendship doesn't work, it doesn't exist. So the main challenge for a Rawlsian conception of civic friendship is to make it compatible with reasonable pluralism. John Rawls's own view of what he called a well-ordered democratic society doesn't fit well with the classical Aristotelian idea of a political community that is held together by the bonds of civic friendship. First of all, according to Rawls, a political society is not a community. By this, he meant that liberal democratic citizens in a well-ordered society do not share a conception of the good, nor may they reasonably be expected to share such a conception. Therefore, we can say that the idea of Rawls and civic friendship cannot be an Aristotelian idea of friendship for virtue. Similarly, Rawls explicitly argued that a well-ordered democratic society is not an association. By this he meant that liberal democratic citizens do not adhere to, jointly pursue one particular end, and they cannot be reasonably be expected to pursue altogether a particular end. Therefore, Rawls and civic friendship is not an Aristotelian friendship for utility. Yeah, Rawls certainly didn't think that a well-ordered democratic society is totally devoid of any general purpose. He argued, again explicitly, that citizens in a well-ordered democratic society, he called a well-ordered democratic society a fair system of cooperation between free and equal citizens. So what liberal democratic citizens share is not a particularly a particular publicly established end. but they share a commitment to cooperate on fair terms with one another. So we may say, together with Rawls, that they pursue a variety of their own private ends, but while they do so, they pursue their common shared end of justice. Well, I would say that an idea of friendship for justice is not a trivial idea. It needs some clarification. And helpfully, we can find such a clarification in R.J. Leland's recent paper in Philosophy and Public Affairs. I still cannot share my presentation. So I can share with you the quote from R.J. Leland, but please believe me, if you haven't seen the paper, that he offers four necessary and sufficient conditions that a relation between citizens has to meet in order for it to be a relation of civic friendship. And to simplify the wording of these conditions is rather complicated. So I won't read it. I just give you sort of a summary of that. It could be summarized in two main conditions. First of all, civic friendship obtains if citizens non-instrumentally value social cooperation for mutual benefit. And another, the second condition, is that they help together, help one another through participation in politics. So what does it mean to value, to non-instrumentally value social cooperation for mutual benefit? If we try to decipher that based on R.J. Leland's paper and another earlier paper that he wrote together with Han van Wiertmarschen, we can say that it means that for liberal democratic citizens, fair social cooperation is an immediate realization of certain basic liberal values, such as liberty, equality, safety, and most importantly, probably in the first place, fair social cooperation is an immediate realization of the value of reciprocity. Sorry. So, liberal democratic citizens in a well-ordered society stand in a relation of civic friendship to one another because they reciprocate, or they are committed to reciprocity, and they are willing to help one another through participation in political life. And Rawlsian political liberals argue that citizens reach this kind of friendly relationship with one another insofar as they abide by the requirements of public reason, insofar as they justify their preferred legal provisions to one another only on the grounds of reasons that all may reasonably be expected to accept. The key notion here is the notion of reasonableness. Reasonable citizens are those citizens who abide, who recognize the burdens of judgment, which means they do not argue on behalf of the whole truth. They do not claim that their legislative proposals or their objections against legislation are based on the whole and the ultimate truth about whatever, morality, universe, and so on. And in addition, they are willing to abide by fair terms of cooperation. So insofar as liberal democratic citizens are reasonable, they do not justify their preferred legal provisions on the grounds of conception on the grounds of comprehensive doctrines, because they know that the truth of these doctrines is controversial, and they cannot reasonably achieve anything if they try to impose their vision of the whole truth on their fellow citizens. And they try to find some justifications that all may reasonably be expected to accept, something that is acceptable to all. And as a result, Rawlsians argue, we maintain reciprocity with one another, and we stand in relationships, in a kind of political relationship, when we help to one another to realize our interests. Well, isn't it so? If we support only those laws that all may reasonably be expected to accept, it seems that somehow we help one another, and we act reciprocally towards one another. My point is that all this adherence to the requirements of public reason helps to maintain reciprocity, no doubt about that. That's pretty reciprocal. But I insist that abiding by the requirements of public reason doesn't mean that we necessarily help one another or are willing to help one another through participation in politics. Why do I say so? I say so because, well, public reason is fundamentally incomplete. The mere idea of reasonableness doesn't offer us concrete substantive solutions to all political problems that we may face. Even if we all agree to on one and the same liberal conception, political conception of justice, for example, Rawls's justice as fairness, still very deep disagreements among us remain. For example, we may disagree about which kind of social and economic system is best realizes the idea of justice as fairness. Is it free market? Is it property owning democracy, which Rawls advocated for? Or maybe it's some kind of liberal socialism, whatever that means. Or for example, to take something more down to earth and something more trivial, we may disagree on whether or not the government is justified in imposing requiring vaccine passports. And while we disagree about vaccine passports, for example, we may rely on one and the same Rawlsian conception of justice. We may ground our arguments for and against vaccine mandates in some general liberal political considerations. We may say that vaccine mandates are good because they are instrumental in rebuilding our economy, in returning quickly to a life as normal, and so on and so on. We may decisively object against vaccine mandates on the grounds that they, of course, somehow enhance state surveillance and rise the level of state surveillance over our everyday lives and our everyday decisions to some unacceptably high level. And at this point, deeply disagree about the policy of vaccine mandates or vaccine passports, but at the same time, we are arguing within the constraints of public reason. And I do not see anything in the idea of public reason that suggests that this debate should be somehow limited or stifled. On the contrary, insofar as we are within the constraints of public reason, insofar as we are within the remit of liberal political conceptions of justice, we are in full right to advance our position through relevant governmental agencies, through the parliament, or we may try to advance these measures or argue against them through courts. So it means that as a result, abiding by the requirements of public reason does not exclude robust partisan contestation over political issues. And while we engage in this robust partisan contestation, we do not help each other through participation in politics in any meaningful way. Those who are for vaccine passports and those who are against vaccine passports do not seem to help one another through participation in politics, nor may they reasonably be expected to, because it turns out that, I'm concluding, it turns out that the requirements of public reason can be met and liberal justice can be pursued and realized without citizens helping one another through participation in politics. So liberal justice and reasonable pluralism can be realized in a society without civic friendship. And my final pitch is that any attempt to somehow build the ideal of civic friendship into the basic structure of society cannot be publicly justified. Liberal democracies are not meant to make citizens act as if they all wanted to help one another through participation in politics. And this is, I argue, this is what distinguishes liberal democracies from totalitarian regimes, illiberal democratic regimes, or regimes that are captured by populist movements. Free competitive elections, political partisanship, separation of powers exist not in order to make it easier for citizens to enforce cooperation despite their deep disagreement, but precisely for the opposite purpose. These agonistic institutions enable citizens to peacefully refuse to cooperate when they think that the terms of cooperation proposed to them are unfair. And precisely these liberal democratic institutions are suppressed in those political regimes that reject liberalism. And the standard for justification for this suppression is precisely the necessity to maintain solidarity and civic friendship around some dogmatically postulated cultural, national, or civilizational values, which are usually taken from a comprehensive doctrine of the group. So public reason is meant to exclude such justifications for political solidarity imposed by the state. And therefore, the politics of civic friendship is at odds with public reason. Thank you very much for your attention. Sorry if it's been a little bit messy without this helpful PowerPoint.
Thank you very much, Andre. Well, now it's time for the floor of those of you attending the panel. I have to say that there has been a person missing, Zlata Bozak. In the end, cannot participate in this panel. So that's a pity, because we cannot listen to him or her. But on the other hand, we have more time for discussion. So I will break the glass by putting a question to both first Christoph and then Andre, with your permission, in order for people attending this panel to have a chance to think over a question. My question to Christoph would be the following one. I mean, I was kind of I was kind of struck by the fact that in the former roundtable, the opening roundtable we just had an hour and a half in this symposium, one of the panelists, Professor Moreso, referred to that brief essay written by the young Rawls, A Brief Inquiry into the Meaning of Sin and Faith. And he also could appreciate, could defend that there is an internal link between what he, as a young scholar, wrote as a dissertation for Princeton University and what later became his egalitarian or anti-meritocratic conception of justice. And now then you, Christoph, you draw also a line to this underlying continuity that you mentioned between A Brief Inquiry into the Meaning of Sin and Faith and his understanding of the right, the good, the deontological and the theological. So let me just put a silly question, but if this is so, I mean, if that brief dissertation written by a young scholar at his early age of a scholar was so influential, now we see or now we believe that it was so influential, why did he never pay any attention to it in the sense that why did he simply discarded that as an important text and editors and historians on political thought have recovered it and given it an importance? This is a silly question because if now we are noticing, now we are seeing that there is such an influence of his own writings from the young Rawls to the older Rawls, but we didn't know anything about the younger one. And I'm kind of surprised that we scholars are now seeing these invisible threads between what he first thought and what he first believed and what he later defended. That would be a question for you, Christoph, and question for André. What now? I think both presentations have been very good. Apart from sticking to the time you had, which I do thank to both of you. But I found them very interesting. But in your case, André, the idea of helping, the idea of understanding civic friendship as having to do with readiness, an attitude to help one another. If I understood well, to political participation, help one another in order for each individual, each citizen, to have a proper and political participation as an equal stance. What do you think, in order to grasp better what civic friendship might mean, and maybe in order to make it come closer to what one might also understand by public reason, what would that mean to help all the citizens to take part in the political sphere? And another question closely related to that, would that mean that by political here we should take something, we should understand something broader than merely institutional participation, in the sense that, for example, if I help, imagine that I am not an animalist, I'm not a pro animal rights activist, but I, in a sense, sympathize with them. Would that mean that, for example, I am ready to help those who are pushing for the recognition of animal rights, though I might disagree, for example, with what they are defending, although I, in a sense, sympathize with what they are doing. Now here there is such a with the idea of helping others, particularly with respect to political participation, this opens such a broad arena of possibilities, which kind of confuses me and makes me think that this idea of civic friendship is also a very tricky notion, such a tricky notion that might help understanding why he didn't go deeply into that and he stick to the public reason notion, which might be a little bit more manageable or useful. These two questions, just to break the ice.
Okay, I think I should start because I was the first one. I need to confess that I don't have a very good answer to your question. I thought about it, but we know that this senior thesis role by Rawls was discovered by accident. He never referred to it. And I think the main reason could be for it that Rawls has... I think that the first reason is that Rawls, this thesis was under big influence of his Christian belief. We know that he wanted to become a clergyman. He wanted to study in seminar and so on and so on. And after the Second World War, he lost his faith. And I think this is a main reason for which he didn't refer to this thesis, because his, I don't know how to say, but his overall attitude towards religion, to God and so on has changed. And I think it must have some kind of, I don't know, existential disappointment with religion is behind this reluctance to refer to this thesis. But I think that there are some deeply rooted ideas which shows this continuity between the young roles and the older or the mature roles. I think, on the other hand, it's very interesting because if we look, for example, at A Theory of Justice, and if we look how it was read in the 80s or 90s, we can see that this interpretation, as Rawls confirmed in Political Liberalism, was a kind of misinterpretation. I mean here, communitarian critique and so on and so on. And if we look at this the thesis of the young Rawls, we can see from the we could see that from the beginning it was this kind of interpretation was based on misinterpretation, because if we look at the idea of community or the well-ordered society and so on and so on, and if we look at the role. The ideas of person or society play in the late roles, we can see that there is an underlying continuity here. But really, I don't have any meaningful and final answer why Rawls didn't refer to his senior thesis. I think it must be a kind of existential, personal change which he went through during the Second World War. Yeah, thank you.
If I may add something to this, I think that the mere existence of this early thesis is is a source of a great intrigue for any historian of philosophy, because one of the main Rawls's examples of what a reasonable debate might be and what we do. What we need to do in order to fulfill our commitment to reasonable pluralism is to say that, look, there may be a citizen who is a Kantian, and there may be a citizen who is a utilitarian. And when they debate on legislation, Kantians should leave aside their Kantian moral theory, utilitarians should leave aside their utilitarianism. And suddenly we find out that the young Rawls got a pretty thick conception of a person, of the right, the good, and so on and so on. And moreover, as you brilliantly showed, it is not only deontological, which means largely Kantian, but it also has a huge and pronounced religious influence in that. That is everything what Rawls tried to set aside when he tried to construct the right kind of thinking that is appropriate in the public square. So discovering and digging up these theses is a great asset for any critic of Rawls who would wish to demonstrate that, look, despite all what Rawls says about about a pure political conception of justice and about the neutrality of public reason with regard to any religious or other comprehensive doctrines of the good, this is not quite true, because with the help of Rawls's own early thesis, we can demonstrate that public reason and theory of justice is grounded in Kantianism, and moreover, perhaps somehow even in Christianity, which makes the whole project sort of self-defeating. It is just another manifestation of Kantianism and, God forbid, Christianity. So Rawls is not, so Rawls basically advocates just another comprehensive doctrine of the good, while he is desperately trying to say that he doesn't. So a good asset for any critic of Rawls. In order to vindicate Rawls, so we really have to show that he explicitly tried to distance himself from his earlier thinking, or at least if not abandon his earlier thinking, but to demonstrate somehow that all these thick religious and philosophical ideas are not necessary for being a good liberal citizen in a well-ordered democratic society.
Yeah, Christoph, do you want
to
add?
That's my view of the intrigue here.
Yeah, do you want to add anything?
I think I can agree with Andrei, because I think it, I don't know if I really agree with him, but I try to ask myself, because I think this young theological conception of the young Rawls is a kind of comprehensive doctrine. It's obvious for me, but it is a kind of comprehensive doctrine which can become a subject of unwrapping consensus. So it's comprehensive doctrine in a good way, I think. Yeah, it's reasonable, comprehensive doctrine, I think. But of course, but the second question is very interesting, because there is similarity between Kantianism on the one hand and Christianity on the other hand. Of course it is. And I think that the ideas which I wanted to uncover in this young thesis of Rawls are more general and more abstract than we could say they are Christian or Kantians. I think that the idea, the difference between deontological and teleological conceptions are more general than the difference between, for example, the Christianity and Kantianism on the one hand, and for example, and utilitarians on the other hand, because we should remember that, for example, a part of Christian ethics for roles was as well wrongly defined. I mean here, for example, Saint Augustine or Saint Thomas, which made a mistake of thinking about Christianity or at God in terms of Greek philosophy. I think that Rawls is in this young thesis is mostly interested in rejecting Greek philosophy. I mean theological philosophy, which is based on the notion of the good, as he was mainly interested in rejecting utilitarians, for example, in theory of justice, which as well, it was a kind of, I don't know how to say, but I think it's a wrong conceptualization of ethics, I would say, because it's thinks about ethics, morality in terms of the good. I mean, a kind of impersonal good, not in terms of personal relations, I think, which for us, I'm sure it's better way of conceptualization of ethics and morality and so on and so on. And I think he agree with this idea. All the time, I mean, from the A Brief Inquiry till political liberalism. Because if we look, for example, at the principles of justice, the task of the principle of justice is to regulate interpersonal relations. Of course, in his late philosophy, they are regulated or mediated by law, by institution, and so on and so on. But they are still interpersonal relations. Rawls wasn't interested in seeking or defining the good because he leaves it to other people to do it for themselves. Oh, thank you.
Andrei, I don't know whether if I can agree with you. I agree that the discovery of A Brief Inquiry into the meaning of sin and faith was kind of a discovery, no? It's something we, but some people, I mean, instead of seeing that text as a kind of a proof of the deep comprehensive roots in Rawlsian thinking, they see rather the contrary. They see the proof that Rawls went through a process of purifying his initial deep beliefs in order to come to terms with political thinking, political liberalism. And it could be kind of, for some authors, was kind of a revelation that Rawls himself followed that which he, in the end, in political liberalism, asked all individuals to do, which is this process of restrict yourself from justifying publicly, public justifying your political ideas. Out of comprehensive reasons, keep that in private, simply use those ideas which might be reasonably accepted by other reasonable citizens, having in mind that they have to accept the fact of the patterns of reason, etc. So I mean some might be might say actually the contrary. No, this is a proof, an interesting proof that helps us to see what was Rawls looking for. Rawls was actually asking other individuals to do what he indeed in his life did, which was going from a deeply rooted comprehensive doctrine with a strong compromise to a particular comprehensive doctrine to a political compromise with a political conception of justice, he never unveiled that track, but we in the end unwillingly discovered it. I don't know. I mean, you presented one. There are elements for suspecting that in the end Rawls was trying to defend a particular comprehensive doctrine before other comprehensive doctrines. There is this suspicion that his political conception is more harmonious with some comprehensive doctrines than with others. That might be one reading, but one might say, look, the other reading is also possible. He went through a process of politicization with respect to political reasoning. I don't know whether you told the whole truth, that it might be that there is this other interpretative possibility. But you didn't answer my question.
Yeah. The first question was, what does helping each other through participation in politics actually means? I think on the one hand, it means very simple things. For example, in the United States, Democrats help one another to realize their interests through participation in politics, through trying to win the elections and then pass legislation or contest this the kind of legislation that they don't like, contest that legislation in court. Republicans do the same. They try to help their fellow Republicans realize their interests through participation in politics by doing exactly what Democrats do. But when we say that, well, you know, this political regime is not that good, it would be even better if everyone helped everyone through participation in politics. The current American politics is too divided. There's an obvious lack of civic friendship there. We might want to help, we might want Democrats and Republicans be more helpful to one another when they participate in elections, when they debate and pass legislation, and so on and so on. But we may say that's not a bad thing. Bipartisan legislation, all sorts of agreement, that seems good. Things in politics go faster, go further, politics become more efficient, and we all together build back better, as it's fashionable to say today. What institutional mechanisms, what we can do about our political institutions to sort of facilitate or even to build in this pursuit of civic friendship into the political process, into very institutions themselves. And here I think we enter a very dangerous territory, because the first thing that immediately comes to mind, that the institution of judicial review is very bad. Even if you're in a minority and you fail to block the legislation that you oppose in the parliament, you still have a chance to block that through courts. that's very bad. That's, we may say, that's very unfriendly towards the majority of your fellow citizens. And judicial review is undemocratic, and so on, disrespectful of the will of the people. And basically, it is in stark contradiction with the idea of civic friendship. If we are supposed to help one another through participation in politics, at least we are supposed to give absolute respect to the majority of our citizens. So the idea of civic friendship, at the very least, is doesn't fit well with the agonistic institutions of liberal democracy, with all these complicated systems of checks and balances and separation of powers and this partisan contestation and so on. All these kinds of things, they rather block our collective decisions. They rather serve to block legislation. They make it very difficult for the government to actually enact and realize policies rather than the contrary. And liberal democratic politics is a kind of agonistic endeavor, not an endeavor where all citizens gather together and sit and think how they can help one another across deep disagreement. And frankly, for me, the first Freudian association with the expression civic friendship that comes to mind, the first Freudian association, guess what? Enemies of the people. If all the people are supposed to be friends with one another, when something goes wrong, when someone objects, is he or she an enemy of the people or not? Friends do not argue. Friends do not block legislation. Friends do not oppose the majority of other friends. They don't dare doing so. So, we may describe what helping one another through participation in politics means when we describe political partisanship. But when we try to think of civic friendship as a more encompassing relationship, that a kind of relationship that all citizens stand to one another, we get basically a one-party state, or at the very least, we have populism. Maybe not institutionalized. We may still have two or more parties, but we definitely get a populist kind of politics where each party puts forward or puts the slogan of civic friendship and then starts accusing the opposition in not being friendly enough and therefore in not realizing our sort of basic idea of democratic and liberal citizenship. Maybe, by the way, when we start reflecting on how this extreme polarization has become possible recently in the United States, maybe we find out that the idea of civic friendship is precisely what each of the two parties is exploiting against the other party. Everyone claims that, well, our opponents are so friendly towards us, why can't we agree with each other? And as Republicans try to always like to say, why can't we start debating reasonably and rationally? And why can't we stop accusing each other of immorality and some evil plans or evil attempts to undermine our our whole society. But while doing so, they demand too much of their opponents. And that's why they get stuck in this polarization and only deepen. We just need to stop expecting that our opponents will act friendly and just content ourselves with our opponents acting as our, not as our enemies, but as our as competitors in a sports match. For example, by the way, Rawls, as one of examples of what he understands by civic friendship in the theory of justice, Rawls wrote about two teams playing football. But this strikes me as a very weird example for Rawls, but because especially if we take football in American meaning of that word, not English soccer, but American football, where they put on heavy armor on themselves and crush one another. This is the opposite of what friends do to each other. American football is very unfriendly game. If the opposite teams tried to act as friends towards one another, no one would watch that. They just would do what they're supposed to do on the field. So the whole idea of civic friendship, I think, doesn't fit well with the rest of Rawlsian conception, with public reason and justice.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't know if there is any question by any one of the people attending this seminar. I would just, we have some minutes still for the hour. And at some point, you, Andrei, mentioned the idea, you referred to the idea of just, you made the close connection, I think, between the idea of friendship and solidarity at some point in your exposition. And don't you think there is a difference here between friendship and solidarity? I mean, as you perfectly know, Rawls in the theory of justice, he said, well, the first principle kind of represents the idea of liberty. The second principle, the first part of the second principle, fair quality of opportunities, kind of serves the purpose of helping promoting the idea of equality. Whereas the third principle, the principle of difference principle, expresses the third ideal in modern political thought, which is solidarity. Fraternity. There might be a distinction between fraternity and solidarity on the one hand, but then again, I think that's my hunch. I mean, that there is a distinction between solidarity or fraternity, if we put them together as synonymous, and civic friendship or friendship. Take the example of G.A. Cohen, for example, when he refers to fraternity or solidarity, when he says, well, that has to do with the fact that we don't leave people behind. We don't abandon them. So if you go on a camping, that's his famous example. If you go on camping and you are, well, doing an excursion somewhere, and some of us, well, kind of has a problem and he does not follow our rhythm. He cannot follow our rhythm. We will not leave him behind. We will stop in order for us to go all together. We will not say to that person, well, you will, in the end, you will reach where we are going to. So we wait for that person. And according to G.A. Cohen, that expresses the ideal, the intuition behind the ideal of fraternity and solidarity. Well, my thinking is, you don't need to be a friend of someone in order to understand solidarity and fraternity in that sense of not leaving people behind. Don't you think that when Rawls was referring to civic friendship, maybe he was simply hitting at the idea of fraternity or solidarity understood in G.A.S. Cohen's terms, following this example, not leaving anyone behind, but doing something for him, even through institutional measures, in order to make him feel that we take him, take her into account, and we are not leaving him behind. Although we are not friends, because friendship is a thick concept which demands some sort of community, at least a minimal community. No, don't you think that he simply wrote too much when he?
Regarding this example, Cohen example of going on a trip together, on a hike together, I think there's, I would say that the idea of friendship requires a certain level of solidarity that is higher than what is required by the idea of liberal citizenship and so on. So if we take this Cohen example of going on a hike together, friends, of course, would not leave anyone behind just because someone is incapable of keeping up with the speed of everyone else. They'll slow down in order to get to the final point together. But a group of liberal democratic citizens that go together on a hike, I guess they would do something else. They'll just leave enough food, water, and everything else necessary with those who prefer to walk slowly or cannot walk fast, and all the rest will go, will charge forward as fast as they can. So in a sense, we leave someone behind because some people get to the final point earlier than others. But in the other sense, we do not abandon others to their own fate altogether. We respect them. Here we get into this classical idea of what kind of respect Waltz is talking about. I think, yes, he's talking about this basic recognition respect, not appraisal respect. We respect everyone else as our fellow citizen in a sense that there's some, everyone has a basic say in the society. Translating it into this analogy of going on a hike together, no one is supposed to put in such conditions during this hike that he simply dies or starves or gets some severe injury and so on. We don't force you to run towards the finish line. We do not force you to climb the mountains that you cannot climb. But at the same time, we are not obligated to carry you on our shoulders everywhere. If some of us can get higher, let them get higher and let the rest have a nice picnic at the bottom of the mountain. And by the way, this might sound a little bit cruel, but frankly, it's not cruel, because if we try to really sort of, again, translate this analogy of someone climbing to the top of the mountain and the rest having a nice picnic at the bottom of the mountain, probably this analogy suggests that we should grant everyone unconditional basic income, for example. We should leave aside, again, against rules, we should leave aside all these moralistic ideas about a human being. No human being must get something for nothing. Well, why is that? If we are at the stage of progress when we can literally feed everyone on this planet, and we can literally provide shelter for everyone on this planet, and not everyone on this planet is really required to work in order to be able to eat and have a roof over one's head. So maybe it's time to leave all this moralistic, stupid stuff about you must do something in order to get what's in order for your basic needs to be met. So the idea of, and frankly, my final word, I don't like this analogy of going on a hike. A political society, again, is composed of very diverse individuals with whose interests and conceptions of the good and whose idea of a good life clash with one another so sharply, so severely, that it is not a friendly trip. It's not a friendly endeavor from the very beginning. So the whole analogy is flawed.
Well, if there is, it's 10 to the hour. I was about to say plenty of time. There is always the need for more discussion because these subjects are not easy and they are passionate for all of us. But it would be nice for us to stop a little bit, some minutes, 9 minutes earlier, in order to have lunch and have that break before the next session. Christoph, Andrei, those of you who attended at home or somewhere else, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for taking part in this symposium. See you around sometime, hopefully.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Bye. Bye.